Should we do it?
Let's do it. Yep. Can I start, Tom?
Of course.
Everyone, welcome to a Your Amigos ASCO GU podcast. Tom and I are here with Pedro Barata, our friend and colleague, former fellow of mine at Cleveland Clinic, went to New Orleans for a while, now back in Cleveland, unfortunately after a devastating Browns loss, but back in Cleveland at University Hospital. So Pedro, welcome. We're going to talk, you gave the discussion about the two big adjuvant renal studies presented.
Congratulations on that, Pedro.
Thank you.
Yeah, Checkmate 914, which had a part A and a part B. Part B was presented, and then obviously the keynote data, which has updated survival results. So why don't we start with, you can introduce yourself briefly, mm-hmm. and then just give us a top line summary of the new data for these studies presented at ASCO GU.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for taking me on your podcast. I feel like more responsibility of being here.
Taking us on is discussion. A phrase we've not had before, but it sounds like we've got some moral obligation to make it work well.
I just want to say a few more pressure to be like with you both than doing the discussion. So how about that?
Oh, I wouldn't take it that seriously if I were you. I don't think anyone else does.
But anyway, so thank you for having me on. So I joined University Hospital Seidman Cancer Center. I lead the clinical research there for the MedOncs for GU tumors, and mainly do kidney and prostate cancers there. And we have a great group. Brian knows Jorge Garcia very well as well, and Pratik and Jason and others. So anyway, it was fantastic, you know, to actually get the opportunity to really put these two trials into context. I can certainly review that very, very briefly, remind the design for the audience. So Checkmate 914, which Dr. Moser presented very nicely about, actually presented a part B of the study. Just a reminder, both part A and part B, they were mutually exclusive, but taking patients with localized clear cell RCC post-surgery who were at a high risk for surgery, who were at a high risk for relapse. And the key point here, they tested 6 months or shorter duration of ipi/nivo in the part A, and then part B, they had two cohorts, one for nivo, 6 months, one for ipi/nivo. This part B, I'll focus more on the adjuvant 6 months nivolumab. And then the study that Dr. Moser also presented a third interim analysis on was actually the Keynote 564.
I think that was Tony, not Dr. Moser.
Oh, excuse me. Tony presented was Keynote 564. So here's an adjuvant pembro for a year versus placebo. And we were coming into ASCO GU knowing the press release that revealed an overall survival advantage favoring patients treated with pembrolizumab. And in most of my discussion was around that updated survival benefit that we didn't know thus far.
I was just going to say, I mean, to me, obviously really important data. You know, Tom gave the discussion at ESMO, and we've been confused ever since about why all these studies.
I wasn't results.
Not because
confused.
Of you, Tom, of course.
Yeah.
You,
well, actually, it was quite a confusing talk.
Now we have Nevo mono data. I think with the other studies, we said, well, Atezo's a PD-L1. You know, Prosper had some issues around study design and patients dropping off. Ipi-Nevo adjuvant was the hardest to explain. But now we have Nevo monotherapy data and Pembro monotherapy data. And what I think, correct me if I'm wrong, are broadly similar populations. But we have very different results, right? One, flatly negative and one wildly positive. And I'm just confused as to why.
Can we just go through the numbers, if that's possible?
Yeah.
All right, the numbers.
So let's just look at the numbers. If we could, if you could give us the Ipi-Nevo numbers for PFS-OS, then the Nevo numbers for PFS-OS, and then the Pembro numbers for PFS-OS.
Sure. So starting with Checkmate 914 for Ipi-Nevo part A, the hazard ratio for disease for survival is 0.92, not statistically significant, of course, and we didn't see data for overall survival, was not reported. During ASCO GU, Dr. Moser presented...
The OS data was presented in the New England Journal of Medicine paper. The OS signal for Ipi-Nevo is out there and is negative. It's a very flat negative result.
Yeah. For the Nevo, for the Part B, the Nevo cohort, which I think included about 400 plus patients, the hazard ratio for disease-free survival was 0.87. I didn't see the hazard ratio for overall survival here. Flat negative, as Brian alluded to. The Keynote 564s, I think, the hazard ratios change a bit. I'm just mentioning the numbers that we have, the updated numbers. So for disease-free survival, positive of 0.72. And then for overall survival, we've seen an hazard ratio of 0.62, I believe.
Yeah. So my question remains, we have a consistent DFS signal sort of in the 0.7 range for Pembro. The OS signal was in the 0.5 range on those first interim analysis, settles in at 0.6 in significance. So again, I don't think anybody would argue those aren't sort of clean positive data, but we have this repeated negative data with Nevo or Ipi-Nevo.
So the PFS goes 0.68, 0.63, 0.72 or 0.74. So yeah. I agree. It's sort of somewhere between 0.765 and 0.7 and consistent around that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for agreeing with me, Tommy. I
sometimes
that.
Like to interrupt.
Let me ask Pedro a question.
What is it? Because I like to interrupt
ask.
And then pretend it's my point. And many people come back to me and say, God, Tommy, I love that point you made when you disagreed with Brian. And actually, all I do is just agree with what he says. And everyone thinks it's me. It's magic.
Pedro, please. So what do you think? I mean, what's the difference here? Why are we seeing these discrepant results? That's the
yeah, I think that's a $1 million question. I think when I was putting this data into context, and you've seen the slide at ASCO GU, and we're looking at the single agent Pembro and Nevo in the metastatic setting, right? So I basically highlighted the data from Mike Atkins on that cohort A and also the Keynote 427 from David on Pembro. And actually the PFS from him actually looks a little bit better. I mean, obviously small study, single arm. The responses seems to be a bit higher for Pembro, right? When we look at response rate for the Keynote compared to the cohort A of the HCR
Pedro,
study. But
are you saying you think Pembro is a better drug?
I don't want to say that for a fact, because I don't think we can make that claim. I think certainly I start to believe more than perhaps. Definitely PD-1s might be better than PD-L1s, or at least that has been the case.
I'll buy that, but Nevo and Pembro are not exactly the same drug, but they are both PD-1 inhibitors.
Right.
And we're not currently going, there isn't currently an environment in other tumor types where saying Pembro is definitely better than Nevo.
Yeah, that's a good point, Tom. I would say a couple of things. So first, we're comparing 6 months of Nevo versus 1 year of Pembro. So that is an important difference, in my opinion. The second, there's another difference in the design that might be relevant. So, for example, I think we look at the group of M1, the post-metastasectomy. I mean, the Keynote took about 6% of those patients. Checkmate did not take any of those patients. So,
but in the subset population, the forest plot of the Pembro trial was positive for OS and PFS, irrespective of that M1-NED population.
That is true, but if you look at the subgroup analysis for disease-free survival, you kind of see you get lower, hazard ratios as you get a higher risk for recurrence, right? So,
but if it's say 6% of the population, it doesn't push it that much, and...
Right, but it's another component, right? I don't think it's just that, but more... 1 year of Pembro, you get a few more patients who are more likely to benefit from it. You also have higher number of sarcomatoid in the Keynote compared to Checkmate.
Let's talk about the duration question. That's the obvious glaring difference, mm-hmm. right? Those other things are subsets of 6 or 8%. They're probably unlikely to drive the results. Tom, let me finish. If I look at the curves for Part B for Nevo monotherapy, they're pretty much entirely overlapping for 6 months.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas if you look at the first part of the Pembro curves for 6 months for DFS, they're far apart. And in fact, they're almost 9-10% apart at 12 months. So they look very different if we're just looking at that 6 months. If the Pembro curves were together and then split after 6 months, you could say, you just didn't give enough and the benefit was really a little later or something. But they're really very different curves in those first 6 months. So I hear the duration argument, but I'm not sure the data supports it.
Brian, I don't disagree with you. It's interesting if you look at the DFS curves also, at the medians at least, how did the control arms perform? I believe overall they landed kind of in a similar rate of events. We're talking, I think, roughly 75% or so, right? So you know, so I think the difference that we see with Pembro and we don't see with Nevo has to do with the active arm, right?
Petra, I love that. I love that point. And, you know, people talk about this risk population and, you know, it's all this hypothetical risk, T2, T1, G3, whatever it might be. The risk is the performance of the control arm. That's what your risk is. You know, if you've got 70% versus 80%, you know, in the control arm of the two trials, that the riskier population is the 70%, not the 80%.
Right.
I don't think we spend enough time actually saying the control arm tells you the risk of your population, not the baseline characteristics, which we seem to be obsessed about.
Tom,
and
do
the
you
other
think,
bit.
Do you, I'm going to interrupt you.
Go with that.
But you would agree with Pedro that the risk, the performance of the control arm is similar in these two trials, broadly.
Yes,
similar.
They are. And that's why the populations are similar.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's
so we
why
agree on that. So what do you think, Tom, of the duration argument?
I think it's absolutely fundamental. Is the community bought into the concept that 6 months is enough? And I am not convinced the community's bought into that. I hear what you say.
Look at the shape of the curve.
No, why? I agree with you. I agree with you. Okay. I think the wider community is going to be under pressure to say there are more similarities and differences between Pembro and Nevo. And I think people are going to be uncomfortable saying Pembro is a better drug. And I think these glaring difference between duration, you wouldn't only give 6 months of therapy, PD-1 therapy, to advanced disease. I don't think anyone has the appetite for that. I think we all feel you need to give more than that. And so therefore, I think it's reasonable to say 6 months isn't enough. And that is the obvious explanation between the two. And to be honest, Brian, I think you're a bit, but you're a bit geeky. I'll be honest with you and the listeners now. You're just a bit geeky. You're a bit too geeky around this.
You spend a lot of time looking at Kaplan-Meier curves.
I spend an unhealthy amount of time looking at Kaplan-Meier. I've been told to put the curves down and walk away quietly. I agree with what you say. But the audience, the casual observer, is going to come around here and say, look, they gave 6 months of therapy. They took a risk. It was a risk. It's probably not enough. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree on that. And that's why the trial is negative.
I don't agree.
I don't agree with me either, but I know that's what people are going to say.
Pedro, what do you think? Do you think this duration is a key issue, or are we getting distracted by it?
Well, I mean, when you look at the curves, Brian, the more you spend time at the curves, I think the more we would say, you know, it doesn't explain the full story. So I agree with you on that. I think it's multifactorial, to be quite honest with you. Now, with that point, going back to the difference between drugs, I mean, I do have to highlight, I did a lot of work finding out what was going on beyond kidney cancer, right, in solid tumors. And actually, you know, Pembro is the first PD-1 to ever shown a survival advantage in adjuvant, in the pure adjuvant trial across any solid tumor. So we've seen survival advantage with ipilimumab in melanoma, but we have, and I showed that, you know, a few of the phase 3 trials shown a disease-free survival advantage across any solid tumor. There's one, there's two Nevo studies, there's a few more. There's three or four studies with Nevo that showed positive DFS, but in reality, we've only seen a survival advantage with ipilimumab and now with pembrolizumab. So I don't know the answer if Pembro is the same or better than Nevo, but certainly when we go across solid tumors, I think this is an important fact to highlight.
I think there are some nice neoadjuvant lung studies with chemotherapy that are hitting survival. So I think some of the lung Nevo data looks quite good.
So Tom, just to clarify, I mentioned specifically pure adjuvant immunotherapy trials. So exclude from the perioperative approaches where we might doing, you know, a few other things, right? Like incorporating chemo and so forth. I think you're right on that.
Should we change gears a little bit? So let's go back to this CheckMate 214 trial, because that's where the story begins, I think, with ipi-nevo not succeeding. And I think that was a big surprise for me. But we showed the OS signal there. I want to talk about the OS signal of nivolumab in a minute. I want to come to that. I'm not going to park that completely. But within that, we did show some nice data, because some people say to me, it was a bad study. And it was just flat negative because of censoring. And the question is, the sarcomatoid population and the PD-L1 population for ipi-nevo actually was quite compelling. And that suggested to me it was doing something, and it wasn't that the trial was poorly conducted or there was too much censoring in the study or whatever, but actually it just didn't work for whatever reason, which was surprising. What did the biomarker data show for the nivolumab arm of 914?
So Tom, just to clarify, I'm sorry, you're talking about the CheckMate 914, yes? Not 025?
Yeah, I'm talking about 914. Okay. So I'm talking about ipi-nivo versus placebo,
right,
high risk. Yeah, part A.
Okay, gotcha. And by the way, when I review that, I mean, we can go back to survival. They threw the numbers for events on that Lancet paper, right? You know, and I think there's an appendix that actually show the curves. And it's flat negative, to your point. I didn't see the AHR, but to your point. So the question is, possible biomarkers? Is that the question?
I think, yeah. Did we show the same trend for benefit in those subsets to show that actually the drug was doing something in subgroups, which actually pulls us away from the hypothesis that the whole trial wasn't a very great trial? I think some people look at the PROSPER study, the one cycle of neoadjuvant nivolumab, which we've not talked about yet, and says, you know, that was negative because of all the heavy censoring and all the dropouts and bits and pieces. But in the PD-L1 positive population and the sarcomatoid population, did the single agent nivolumab do anything in the 914 trial?
I see, got you. So yeah, so going back first on the ipi-nivo on the part A, you know, when you look at the subgroups, because I don't think we got, you know, I might be wrong, but, you know, when you look at the part A, you had around, so remember the expression, the PD-L1 tests were different, right? For both CheckMate part A and B, mm-hmm. The S is different from the other. So I think we're talking between 11 to 14 or so percent PD-L1 positive. So it will be higher for ipi-nivos, around 40%. You're right. I mean, it's very, very low hazard ratio. It's 0.4. You know, so with ipi-nivo and 0.53 for nivo. And then for sarcomatoid, we're talking like 5 and 7%. Again, very low hazard ratios, 0.29 and 0.42 with the ipi-nivo and with the nivo. So to your point, Tom, you know, if we want to see it beyond the negativity of the trial, you know, and that was one of the points I was trying to make is it possible to look at sarcomatoid in PD-L1 as possible subgroups where, you know, definitely they seem to be enriched for immunotherapy, you know, activity, and not just with ipi-nivo, but also with nivo. So I do believe that to be the case. And I actually think that gets into our discussion on a daily practice, like, you know, when we're thinking what patients we should consider. I personally don't do PD-L1 in clinic, but like if I see sarcomatoid, I'm more inclined to take that into my decision to have the, you know, the when I have the conversations with patients about it. So.
Pedro, let me ask you about PD-L1. I'm looking at the table that you presented about the, you know, across the adjuvant trials and the updated data. And one of the glaring differences mm-hmm. is in PD-L1 expression, right? It's in the 10 to 15%.
Yes.
In the CheckMate studies, it's 74% in Pembro. And I totally understand they're different assays. And maybe that explains everything, but
yeah.
Is there a hypothesis that one of the reasons that the Pembro study has been positive is it?
Oh, we've lost Pedro. He's going to rejoin us. I can answer that question, Brian.
Is that it enriched intentionally or not for PD-L1 positivity?
So the way that the two groups measure PD-L1 is very different. The way that BMS are measuring PD-L1 is the tumor cell staining. And exclusively. And actually, if you look, they sometimes have 1%, but more recently, you've been using a 5% cut point. And that's why it only comes down to about 25% of the population. So it's very high tumor cell staining of PD-L1. The problem with immune cell staining of PD-L1, the issue with immune cell staining is lots of immune cells, antigen-presenting cells, express PD-L1. So inevitably, it becomes quite a powerful prognostic marker because normally antigen-presenting cells are associated with good outcome. And so the issue is that, you know, when you, as the Merck assay, which includes tumor cell and mm-hmm. immune cell staining, when you combine those two together, you're really looking at two completely different populations. And in the Merck study, the fact they've got 74% is because they're using a different cut point. They're using tumor cell and immune cell.
So you think it's
just
methodological?
It's purely methodological.
Yeah.
And we've seen the same across different tumor groups. And what I can tell you, and having spent a lot of time with this, is each tumor group has very, very different PD-L1 predictive and prognostic prognostication. And we know, you know, from there are some lung cancer trials where pembrolizumab work using their staining has worked very well. There's some tumor cell staining studies that work well, and in urothelial cancer it's messy. And actually in kidney cancer we've never really shown these consistent signals. Now some people say that's because we keep using a different test to measure the biomarker.
Yeah.
But I really wouldn't focus on that PD-L1 as a marker here.
So let me ask you, as Pedro rejoins us, so he presented an algorithm for how to approach patients given all the data, and then also, you know, some Twitter polls about what people were doing, and which really hasn't changed over time, although this was before they saw the full data. And most people, about half, were not giving Pembro to everybody who would have been eligible, but sort of to the higher risk group, and people probably define that differently. So, and that's what I've been doing in practice, and I think we'll probably continue to do. But what do you think the right approach is? Do you think it's a year of adjuvant Pembro for everybody, even the lowest risk of the eligible patients? Or do you think it's a more selective approach, and how would you select?
I mean, I think with overall survival, the conversation changes a little bit. I mean, what I've been saying to patients up to now is that the drug will delay the time to the cancer coming back. There's evidence that that's definitely the case in this trial, although it hasn't been consistent across lots of different trials. We feel that delaying the time to the cancer coming back is important, and there's a trend towards overall survival, but it may be that subsequent therapy can rescue, you know, the patients, and it may be that you don't need the treatment now. We don't know that. There's a 50% chance or more than that of you not needing the treatment at all and you're going to be overtreated, and there's a 10% chance of a life-changing toxicity. And when you pull all that together, you know, that I agree, many patients were coming back and saying, look, do regular scans, treat me really well when the cancer comes back. But the dialogue has now changed, and that's because there has to be and by the way, there are more patients alive at 4 years and all these landmarks, you know, about 10% more patients alive who have the adjuvant therapy with all of the caveats which I've just talked about, you know, all and that makes the conversation different. And so before, you know, if you, heaven forbid, you're a defensive, you're pursuing defensive medicine, and you're saying, you know, I don't really know that this is benefiting, and I think that piece was understandable without overall survival. But when you hit significant overall survival, I think you have to tell patients that, and you have to say, with all of the caveats I've said now, but there is a chance, there's a higher chance of being alive at 5 years if you have the drug now. And I think that will change in my practice more. You said 50-50 in your practice. I've actually looked at mine and it's quite similar. I think it's going to go more like the 75-25.
Okay, I hear you.
What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I'm still not kind of at the point of everybody. You know, again, the M1, which we talked a little bit about in terms of having even greater benefit, you know, I don't wonder if it's under treatment for many of those patients, right? Since we don't really do PD-1 monotherapy by and large in an advanced setting. So I don't know. I need to sort of sit and think about it. I agree it totally changes the conversation with patients,
yes,
right? And maybe it pushes more docs and or patients as it should towards treatment. I'm probably not at the point of it pushing everybody.
But I'm going to push you. I'm going to push you a bit harder. Pedro, welcome back. So, I'm going to push you a bit harder. And Pedro, I'm also going to ask you this question, because both of you have now said to me that you're doing, you know, that we did a trial, it's prospective, it's randomized, we hit DFS, we hit OS, more patients living longer, it's significant. And yet you've gone in your own little way and your own algorithms, and you're picking and choosing patients who you do and don't treat.
Thank you for the patronizing question.
Yeah.
But Tom,
I am an expert of patronizing
questions. Tom, it's obviously all benefit risk, right? There's patients you see who are outside the clinical trial eligible population.
What rights do you have to go in and do that selection?
Because there's risk, right? Because you're treating a lot of patients who don't have cancer, right? So it's very different. It's a very different setting.
Yes.
Right. Even high risk of recurrence, 50% risk, half those patients don't have cancer. You can't possibly help them. Right. So to me, it's a very different equation, you know, in this setting than in other settings.
And Pedro, who are you not treating?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Great question. By the way, it was a great discussion. I agree with all the points made. I think, you know, knowing that about half of them will never recur, half of the patients will never recur, is definitely something I have in mind. There's risk with treatment, which, as you both alluded to, you know, and then on the other side, that's the survey that I also showed, that basically showed that patients perceive the risk of recurrence actually higher than the doctors for each stage. And actually score number one, to put at the top, their risk of dying from cancer. So when you put all these together, the conversations in practice about who to do it, you know, they're not as straightforward as, you know, as what the trial did, right? Even though, you know, Keynote 564 is really, really important and drives a lot of the algorithm that I showed, which is kind of what I do in clinic. So I do tend to select patients, but to be fair, I have the conversation about offering Pembro to all patients that meet eligibility criteria for Keynote. So that is where I start. Some patients said, you know, they already made up their mind and come to me and said, I want everything available. I understand the risks and I want to do it. This kind of patients that sometimes come to us in Cleveland, and other patients are like, doc, what would you do? And I go through, you know, I definitely use a risk score calculator, as I showed, you know, because you put a number on it. Your patients are not numbers, but it helps a little bit to put things into perspective. And I think once they start knowing the numbers, if we were to do the survey to patients, I probably think the what they are thinking can change also when they look at databases, right? But patients, again, are not numbers. So I certainly start a conversation for all, you know, patients who are eligible for Keynote, you know, so intermediate, higher, stage, more in stage twos, grade fours, at stage threes, you know, post-metastasectomy. That's certainly the case. I also take into consideration sarcomatoid features, as I said, you know, and not as much the PD-L1, because I usually don't have that available in clinic. But I do think, though, you know, to start a conversation, knowing the data is relevant and bringing it up and is a way to start. And I just think there are other factors that we have that we bring into the table, right? As you guys mentioned, toxicities, long-term toxicities, et cetera.
And I think, Pedro, you make a good point. I tend to use the Fox Chase nomogram. There are others, and pull up the numbers and just show the patient in the room. You know, I do think those nomograms fall short at the lower end of risk for some reason. I find that if I do two or three different ones, I get very different results at the lower end of risk, which is obviously what we're talking about in terms of deciding whether or not you're going to treat those patients. I think if patients, you know, T4 high grade, node positive, sarcoma type, you know, I think there's probably very little doubt that, you know, barring contraindications, you would treat those patients. It's that T2 high grade that I struggle with. It's that small tumor that's kind of barely has perinephric fat invasion and has T3A, you know, where you're like, is this patient really T3A? You know what I mean? Those are the patients I struggle with, not so much the high risk.
Yeah. This has been fantastic. My last question, we didn't see the OS signal for single agent Nevo. Mm-hmm. Do we know if that's been analyzed? Is that something which we're going to see in the future, or is that going to be part of the publication? Because we do, I've got no idea. I'm guessing it's not positive. Otherwise we'd know. I don't know what statistical analysis plan shows. Do we know anything about that?
It's a good question. I don't think we will for now, from what I could tell. And the other thing is, Tom, you know, the median follow-up for this Part B is actually even shorter by 10 months compared to the Part A, right? And at the time, you know, when you see the Lancet Oncology paper, you know, they were basically commenting specifically of the lack of maturity for overall survival. So I don't think the data is mature for them to show it. And it may come at a later time, but I don't think we'll see it, soon.
So Pedro, my last question, first of all, congrats on a great discussion. These are really, really important data, and the context here and on the discrepant results is obviously really important. But tell us, in 5 years, you mentioned in two of your slides, like optimizing patient selection with ctDNA or RNA-seq or through some of the new vaccines. You mentioned there's still some randomized data, you know, Rampart, which is a UK-based study of Durvin, Tremi, Pembro, Belzu, et cetera. There's some other data and approaches out there. When we're sitting here in 5 years, are we still going to be giving just a year of single agent Pembro to, I'll call them, unselected patients, or patients selected only by clinical features, or are we going to be doing something more sophisticated?
Well, that's a tough question. Yeah,
that's my job.
I think one of the take home points from, you know, where we are today is and just by the survey, right? We all want better patient selection. So I think that's going to be a driving force for what we do in the future. You know, there's certainly efforts that you alluded to that might change a bit. I don't think they'll change as much. I think probably what we're going to start seeing, you know, is, you know, we might take still the idea from Tom, what he's doing in the urothelial carcinoma, right, which is a biomarker-directed approach in the adjuvant setting.
You'd be welcome to do that. You'd be welcome.
You know, it's more difficult because of the low tumor shred in RCC to do it, for example, for ctDNA. But there's other technologies I didn't have as much time to expand on, you know, who might be more sensitive to find the patients who are at a higher risk on a molecular level.
I'm excited about the methylation signatures.
Yeah, exactly. I'll think about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's data from FARB and other groups about methylomes.
I'm up for that.
You know, so that's one. You know, of course, RNA-seq, I think over time we're going to get better in getting that information sooner back, right, to us, you know, because right now it's not reported. So it's hard to say. We got to wait. Now, these patients don't need to start on treatment right away. But, you know, when they see us, probably already 3-4 weeks from surgery and then waiting another, let's say, a month or two, maybe, you know, it won't be, at least currently, it's not like we're not using that information currently. I think in the future it's possible they will see some form of biomarker with RNA-seq or other where we'll use that. So, but I do think that that's the pathway forward. I do believe that we're not going to offer 100% of patients who meet the need, who meet the bill for a Keynote. I don't think we're going to be offering to everyone, to your point, Brian. I think we're going to keep selecting it that way, more clinically, those risk calculators. But I do think the way forward is to kind of incorporate some of this work and try to select those patients that way until we validate that prospectively.
I think we're quite a long way from patient selection
in
clear cell renal cancer as things currently stand.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big issue in this disease. And I think we need to put more effort into this. My last question, papillary renal cancer. Are you treating papillary renal cancer with adjuvant therapy based on the Pembro data?
Yeah. Or not? I'm not currently.
Brian?
Am I? No.
No, neither am I.
No.
Okay, that sounds fair. Pedro, this has been my last question. I thought was going to be more controversial than that, but there we go. You know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Horses for courses. It's horses for courses.
I love it.
Pedro, thanks a lot. Congrats again. Appreciate you.
No, Pedro, fabulous. Fabulous. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you, guys.
Cheers.
Bye. Talk soon.